This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
The applause in the halls of Congress 77 years ago on December 8th, 1941. Congress would declare war less than an hour after that legendary speech from President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Those words were heard over some of these same radio airwaves all those years ago, and they still hold power today as our country prepares to reflect once again on the more than 2,400 American lives lost at Pearl Harbor on that day of infamy. George Vandersloos is 102 years old now, but he still remembers being that 25-year-old Marine from Minnesota aboard the cruiser USS Honolulu, assigned to a 6-inch gun crew.
We had 6-inch guns we couldn't fire. We weren't equipped to do aerial firing. The guns that fired at the planes were, they call them 525s. They were an aerial gun on the decks. It was utter chaos. I mean, everybody was going in a different direction. And directions over the loudspeaker system was one after the other. We had one gunnery officer that kept yelling over the loudspeaker system, "Do not fire, do not fire," at the Jap planes. And we paid no attention to him. Just kept firing. But I have no idea how long it lasted. I would say an hour, maybe a little shorter, maybe a little longer. It was quite a mixed affair after we got firing. And they came in, I mean, they had planes that wouldn't wait. I mean, they came over from the other, they entered our area from the other side of the island. The fellas on that side reported the fact that they looked like Jap planes. Sure enough, they were.
I've heard there was some confusion there because there were B-17s coming in from California, and they said, well, that's what that is.
And we didn't see the B-17s, but yeah, that's right.
And what about the second wave of the attack?
Yeah, shall I say, it was a pretty mixed-up bag of tricks, I tell you. We hardly knew what end was up. It was a little spooky. We didn't know what the right hand was doing to the left. I mean, everything was topsy-turvy. And we were right in the middle of the flag going up. And they hit exactly at that point. The first plane went over our ship. The bugler was... So it was pretty well orchestrated by them. There was, like I say, utter chaos in it. I mean, there was ships trying to get in and try to get out, and it really was a blooming mess. We had a loose Japanese sub floating around in there, and we were chasing that thing around. In small boats, they were chasing that crazy thing all over the harbor. The word I use is utter chaos. It was just a mess. Utter confusion, I mean. Everybody, and the loudspeaker was going constantly, go to your battle stations and do this and do that. Well, we were already in our battle station, and we were kind of isolated because we were in a pretty heavy-duty turret, number two turret, and never fired. You couldn't fire in the Navy Yard. We were kind of helpless is really what it boiled down to. But everything was concentrated 100% on Ford Island or the battleship row, which the ships were tied up to it. They really took a licking. I mean, we were fishing sailors out of the water, floating around out there. They took a very bad beating because they got direct hits. They were concentrating on them to begin with.
And you saw some of those explosions?
Oh, boy, yeah. Yeah, well, we were just across the channel is what they called it. So all in all, it was quite a day.
Well, yeah. And I'm wondering if you can help us understand how that changes your outlook or your emotions when you go from Saturday in this island paradise to Sunday, you're at war and people are dying.
Just a horrible situation. It spooked us all. I mean, we were under the gun and we couldn't really fight back.
I want to talk about the overall picture and the devastation and what you saw. But with regard to your own ship, the Honolulu, you mentioned the bomb that bounced into the side of the hull, and I know there are some near misses too. But when you say it hit your compartment, does that mean that if you had been down in your compartment instead of up doing the flag, that you might have been hurt?
Oh, if I'd have been down in the compartment, it blew a hole in the side of the ship, the bomb did. All of us on the USS Honolulu survived it. I don't know of anybody that was killed.
But there were over 2,400 Americans who were killed that day, and I'm sure that soon became clear to you as you saw the smoke from the Arizona and the Oklahoma and all the ships that were hit. Yeah. Can you describe for me some of the things you saw in the days and weeks that followed, some of the things you had to do in the days and weeks that followed?
Well, I'll get on our ship. We went into dry dock. The Pennsylvania was in there, and they had been damaged. So they pulled it out during the dry dock, and we went in to get repairs on our hull. When that all took place, we pulled into dry dock, high and dry, and we spent, I think about a week in dry dock. They patched up our hull and got us seaworthy again. And from there, we went directly to Bremerton, Washington for repairs, permanent repairs. Rearmed. So that was pretty much the end of my journey on the USS Honolulu.
You're not going to leave out Alaska, are you? Didn't you go up to Kiska and the Aleutians?
The Aleutians, we pulled into Kodiak, Alaska. The Marines have to have something on these islands. So they had barracks and they had all set up. It was a horrible, muddy, up to your ears, rain and snow. And see, the night and days were all kind of confused us too. The Marine barracks there, they were kidding, trying to get me off and get me into the barracks. And I said, oh, no way. Well, you don't seem to like it aboard ship. We'll give you a good, hey, no. Quite an affair, but all mud, mud, mud. Yeah, up to your ears. I mean, you get out in the main drag, and I mean, you were in mud up to your knees or better. Just terrible.
And did you guys go from there and bombard Kiska when they were going ashore?
Yeah, we just bombarded the hell out of them. And the harbor sat in kind of a peekaboo affair. You couldn't see it from the water side. But we dropped a load of 6-inch bombs in there. I tell you, we really... All in all, the Japs knew we were there.
So you participate in that, bombarding Kiska, and the troops make their landings there at ADAC. And then you come back to the Bay Area, into Mare Island?
Bay Area. I got married there. That was my one leave. I had 2 weeks off. This girl I knew had gone with. I have no idea how it all happened, but we got married. We just got a good start. They shipped me down to San Diego. I had an outfit down there. We were being prepared to ship out. The next thing you know, we're going aboard ship.
So they put you in an Amtrak unit, the 10th Amphibious Tractor Battalion. Help people understand what that means. What were the kind of things you and those fellow Marines in that outfit would be doing?
Our job was, we made the first landing. We always went in first, and we carried troops with us. And we invaded as far as we could, and sometimes a little too far. But overall, it was a pretty precarious. We were the first ones in, and I just didn't care for that at all.
And the first one you made was Saipan?
Yeah, Saipan was the first one. Then we went into Tinian, across the way.
What do you remember about that? Because, I mean, this is so different from what you'd been doing aboard ship. And I imagine the amount of enemy weaponry directed toward you is a little different compared to when you were on ship.
It certainly was. There was a surprise every turn. Just about the time you thought you were squared away and knew exactly what was going on, you didn't know anything. All in all, it was quite an experience. I never forget it. I lost a good bunch of buddies in my outfit. I was the platoon sergeant in charge of my outfit. I think really the first true combat feel I had was on Saipan, landing on Saipan, and we were just, of course, right in the process of it, and here comes the Jap planes, and they're just bombing the hell out of us. We came to one spot there where they seemed to be laying. They were firing from the shore onto the breakwater, and we had to go over the breakwater, and that was a pretty touchy situation. If you were real lucky, you'd get over there without getting hit. It was a pretty touch-and-go affair. You know, really, as I look back, with all the commotion that was caused, you kind of lose your marbles on it. You don't remember, and it's just as well that you don't.
Well, that was, you know, one of the questions I often ask, and it sounds cliche, but I think it's real, because when you come really close to not seeing a tomorrow, I think you remember those moments. Are there some close calls that you remember where enemy fire, artillery, machine guns, whatever, came really close to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, once you make a landing and you're on the beach, there were times where I was not in the Amtrak at all. I mean, we just abandoned the thing. One time in particular, it was shortly after we landed at Saipan. I'm in one of the holds, dead Jap laying there. We're taking fire from the hills there, and boy, they're coming too close. So I'm head chopping. I'm going from one hole to the next, and I'm trying to get away from them. And I would say I must have traveled half a mile or so from one hole to the next. And I turn around and look, and geez, they were taking a beating, the areas that I left. But you don't do things knowing what you're doing. Just you're trying to get away from what's happening. But you don't. You just don't quite get away from them. You talk about sweat and blood, boy. I mean, you really do. And the enemy firing on you, it's not a very good feeling. And they're landing. The weapons that they were using, I have no idea, but they were pretty good sized. And they were dropping all around us. They had not trenches, but gullies. It was a sandy affair, so it seemed as though we were exposed all the time. I couldn't get that out of my head. I wanted to get out of sight. Like I say, they were firing up from the hills, and they were looking down at you. It was kind of a spooky affair. It wasn't a picnic.
You know, I always wonder, in situations like this, what's it like when night falls? Are you actually able to sleep? What in the world is going through your mind?
Oh, boy. Yeah, these night affairs can really get spooky. We had that night, the first night in, we well dug in. Boy, they started firing. And they were actually firing from the other island also, from Tinian, because that's just across the channel from Saipan. It gets pretty hairy, and I did not appreciate it at all.
Do you think you got any sleep?
Oh, God, no. Oh, no. I was in this one hole, and they were just giving us holy hell. I had somebody below me, and it was like a bowl of jelly. He was just shaking his fool head off, you know. So when dawn broke, I took a look at him. I knew the kid, and man, his eyes were as big as silver dollars, and he couldn't talk. So I said, "You follow me." So he didn't move, and I grabbed him. And we went down to the beach, and they had a station down there that take them out to the hospital ship. Well, the first spot they hit is under the canvas. They had a big canvas set up. Got down there, and that canvas looked like it was in a sea of jelly. Man, it was just a shaking and a shimming. I have no idea how many men were under it. And the fellow that I took in, they had him under it. So they took them all. I guess the ones that pulled through to the Philippines.
Well, and you described that, what his appearance was, the state he was in. We hear that phrase, paralyzed by fear, and I think a lot of people think that's figurative. But it sounds like you saw the literal definition of paralyzed by fear.
Well, you get to a point where you have to take the bull by the horns. And I was in charge of my platoon, so I had a responsibility. You have to keep your marbles together and do what you can do. And that's exactly what I did.
Yeah, you may have saved his life by getting him out of there.
Yeah.
You mentioned, though, that there were a number of buddies that you lost in combat, whether it was Saipan or Tinian or Iwo Jima, where you ended up.
The first real experience I ran into the dead was on Saipan. We had an awful bombardment that night. And I think it was the second night. The next day, I'm trying to check our men out. Hell, I'd lost a lot of men. I couldn't imagine what happened. Well, they were out picking up bodies and taking them up near the airport, and they had them lined up. What a sight. Just, they were all dead bodies. So then you identify your men. And I think I had a half a dozen of them in there. But some are really beat up badly, you know. So it was alongside of the airport. I'll never forget that. And I got out of there in a hurry. But we, just one day, I had the 6x6 truck. I don't know where I got it, but we're picking up dead bodies. Wow, what a mess. I had about six men with me, and they would throw them in the back. So you get your load and take them back to headquarters. Yeah, it was a smell. Oh, God, what an odor. It wasn't sickening. It was revolting. And some were so beat up. You'd be beat up, too.
Well, and that's my question. I don't want to put thoughts in your head, but I'm just imagining being in your shoes, and I'm wondering if, as you see the dead bodies lined up by the airport, or you're around in this truck picking them up, if you look at these young, some of them just teenage Marines, and you say, that could have been me.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, boy, yeah. Way back in your mind, that's always there. You don't forget the fact that you're under the gun. Yep, I thought of it many times.
Including on Iwo Jima, and we'll find out what he remembers about that invasion when we come back. Find photos and a short video with 102-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor George Vandersloos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.